Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, and today here at Emerald Coast Conference in Destin, Florida, St. Destin to be more accurate, and back with the board bombs, Dr. Blake Briggs, and we're going to talk a little bit about aortic dissection. And if you've been listening to the podcast last few months, we had the can't-miss diagnoses with a little bit of a legal review aspect of things, and talked about that a little bit. And so we're back with a little deep dive here, conversation and lecture that he's having here at Emerald Coast Conference. It's one of those that if you haven't come to this conference before, a lot of the southeastern states, but we added Oklahoma as well, and Montana was on there for a little bit. I didn't see him this year, but it used to be the Southeastern Conference schools, and so North Carolina wasn't invited. Most of the Southeastern Conference states were, and but now it's expanded. Great conference. I've come down here every year for about 12 years, and well worth it for the trip. Bring your family, come to the beach. So that's my plug for the conference. But Dr. Briggs, great seeing you again. Welcome back, and give us a little update of what we've missed out on since we last talked.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a great year, and it's good to see you again. Glad we could all make it down here for the Emerald Coast Conference. As you said, it's just a fantastic opportunity to good family time, good beach time, and also just it's nice that the only option really is you don't have these multiple lectures. You're going to miss different slots like you would at a national conference. You know, they have the lecture material and involvement material is all in the morning. There's a reception in the evening, and you don't have to pick which talks you have to go to. They're all just in that one spot, so it's nice and convenient. So, no, things are going well, and Board Bombs are doing great. We were just presenting at SAM a few weeks ago. We're going to be presenting at ASAP this year. We'll be hosting one of the podcasts at ASAP too, so really exciting opportunities. So things are going well.
Yeah, we'll be. You'll swing by the booth with us.
Absolutely.
We'll be out there as usual, try to knock out our 2025 podcast during the time. Everybody wonders why I don't want to talk at the end of the day at the scientific assembly. And it's absolutely because I've been talking all day and ready just to rest it for a little bit and sit back, relax, listen to other folks. So give us a little background on this discussion on aortic dissection, because it's one of those things that we all fear, you know, especially since the whole John Ritter situation where you're treating a STEMI, and next thing you know, it's a dissection, and the treatment isn't the ideal one. So give us a little background.
Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, when I was a third-year resident, and you think that you're ready to go out and conquer the emergency room, and it's one of those cases you have that makes you wish you went to a four-year program. Mm-hmm. And obviously my program was 3 years. And I remember I was just getting ready to graduate, and I had a very difficult case come in that was a hypotensive patient that had a syncope episode on the toilet. And it turns out we were able to do a rush exam, found a pericardial effusion, drained it at bedside emergently, and then, you know, we pan scanned her and found dissection. And she had never complained of chest pain or back pain or like that. She just came in shock. And this led me to investigate dissections more about how the variation of presentation is a lot. And it actually is fascinating because, you know, when you're a junior faculty member and you are trying to find your niche, trying to find what you're interested in educationally speaking, I remember that one of my mentors told me at Wake Forest that, hey, you're going to find that what that is. You're going to have one of those cases, and this is going to bug you a lot. You're going to have to research a lot and look it up a lot. And for me, I had last March or so, for some weird reason, I guess it was just really bad luck, I had 6 dissection cases in 1 month. And I even told my chair, and he said, well, I'm not going to work with you anymore. So, but what happened is that I started delving into this, and it's really one of those like passions of mine of those diagnoses of why are we missing this and why is this a problem? And the stats say it all. 40% are missed on initial evaluation. 10,000 people die of this annually still. So it's a rare disease, but it's still happening. We're still missing it. And probably one of the most telling studies was that, you know, because people are listening to this, or they think when I mention that, hey, we're really bad at diagnosing this, they're saying, well, we just need to do more CTAs. Well, that's not the answer. Mm-hmm. They did one study several years ago in 2015 that they found greater than 60% of patients with dissection were diagnosed after their death. And they found out, they compared 2 groups of patients. It's a really cool retrospective study. They took cases from 1956 to 1995, and then 1995 to 2015, and they found that the case detection rate didn't change at all, even with the advent of CT. And so they found that that was not just the answer of doing CTAs, and plus the cost, you know, the radiation, the
risk,
to diagnose it, it's just not the answer. So where I'm getting with this is that we need to retool and re-equip the way we're thinking about dissection.
Well, it's one of those things that, to help your attending feel better, you know, at that point is you had 6 cases. It's at least you didn't actually have 10 cases and only found six of them,
right,
which would have been your 40%. But I mean, this is something that's incredibly unusual presentations. I mean, we typically, you learn about the tearing chest pain, growing throat, going through to the back that starts in the chest, kind of starts moving its way down. But I don't know that I've ever had one that I was, as soon as I saw it, was like, oh man, classic, read the book, aortic dissection. It was one, I had one of my, one of the very few thank yous I've ever gotten in terms of letters, was one that just came in with rapid AFib and symptomatic and one of those things that hypotensive, really tachycardic and, you know, kind of got in there and they're like, I'm having chest pain. And you're like, oh, it's just rate related. And come to find out it's dissection. And then one of the more recent ones, because I had three weeks in a row. And so the CT surgeon, the CT surgeon says, I need to quit taking call with you, because it was every Thursday for 3 weeks, I would get a dissection. And one of them, his only complaint was leg spasms. And he came in and says, my legs are spasming. I need something for the spasms. That's all I need. I don't need anything else. Just need something to help with these leg spasms and I can go home. Well, come to find out he had dissected stem disturbed. And he did very well, thankfully. But it's, you know, those things that it's why, and you know, when I have students that work with me and say, it's why you go to as much school as you do, not right. for the stuff that's easy, not for the stuff that Watson could figure out and Google can figure out. It's for the stuff that you have to take into account the human element, the experience element, and the variation in disease presentations, especially when so many of our nerves are not as accurate and as fine motor as, say, our fingers and toes are. But you're talking about the abdomen and chest, which are really more of a proximity something's wrong type nerve sensation, and really doesn't do anything to tell you exactly what it is.
You know, I completely agree. And you really hit the nail on the head there with the visceral aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I compare it to a lot like mesenteric ischemia, and it's one of those, because aorta runs, it's the largest blood vessel in the body, and it covers so much real estate that you're going to have such a variation in symptomatology, one, and then two, patients are going to be difficult in relating that pain because it's so visceral first, you know. This whole tearing back pain that is chest pain and raise the back, whatever, all that does happen. The studies show that it's real, but it's just we have to ask the right questions to get to it. Mm-hmm. Because if you go in the room just, you know, guns blazing, asking, are you having chest pain? You have a tearing back pain. The pain radiates to your back. You know, you're going to get those, you're going to lead the patient astray. You're going to get the answers that you may want or may not want, depending on how they answer. And it may lead you astray from getting to that diagnosis. And I think just having, re-equipping our minds, what I talked about in the discussion in the lecture was that you need to think of the dissection more as a chest pain plus one, or, you know, one plus chest pain, which I originally got, I don't know who came up with this, but I originally got it from Anton Hellman on EM Cases when he talked about his podcast several years ago, I think when I was an intern. And since then, and now as a junior faculty, I still use that, and I still teach to my learners that if you have a chest pain patient that has migrating pain or has you know, the classic sharp or sudden onset tearing pain, you need to be thinking about that. If you're treating your chest pain with opioids because they're in so much pain, that's another red flag. That, you know, typical chest pain patient doesn't look that sick, or it shouldn't be in that much pain or that unwell. And then also the whole neurologic aspect of things, which I think is really fascinating. I think something we ignore is that our dissection patients, there's a high degree of focal neurologic deficits that present with them, or they present like a stroke patient, like you said, the leg spasms or maybe leg weakness. I've had one dissection case before where a man came in, and he was a trucker, so you know something's going to happen to him because they never go to the doctor. He came in with left leg numbness, and he was a code stroke by EMS when he came in. And I remember all I did was just check for pulses, and he had no pulses in his left lower leg, and that's not a stroke. You know, that's some type of vascular issue until proven otherwise. And we went to the CT scanner with neurology, and I asked them, can you just finish the CTA all the way through his aorta? You know, do the stroke code CTA and just finish it. And they did, and he had a Stanford B dissection, and his whole course of management, of course, dramatically changed. Instead of getting TPA, he went to the operating room immediately. So that's just the difference in obviously re-equipping our expectations of what we would see, our disease script, right? Because in medical school, you and I probably learned something completely different than what we see in the real world about aortic dissection.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you read a book, and you know, when you're talking about physiology in medical school especially, everything is pretty cut and dry. You know, this is how it's going to present.
Yes.
This is what it is.
Yes.
You know, your appendicitis is the periumbilical pain migrating to the right lower quadrant with anorexia, nausea, elevated white count, all of those typical type things. And that's exactly that point, is that, you know, the MDDO upper level degrees have nothing to do with expected presentations. It
right.
has to do with catching something that didn't present. And then a lot of that, especially with the chest and abdomen, with that visceral pain discussion, is really about the fact that, you know, people explain things based on their experiences. And so what have they experienced that's somewhat like that before? You know, whether it's heartburn, whether it's a pulled muscle, well, you know, whether it's pleurisy, you know, whatever it is that they've had before that they can relate it to, that what they can anchor an explanation to is how they're going to describe it. And very few people are going to, and it's even better, it's kind of more funny when they describe it and they don't realize that they actually describe it like the book would describe it, like, a little pain in my belly button, now it's way down here, I don't know what's going on. Or I had pain in my chest and now it just seems to be going down towards my belly and into my back, and, you know, whatever it may be when they accidentally describe it correctly. But it is more experiential descriptions that people have, and they're going to try to anchor it to what they know the best. So, you know, that number one chief complaint for acute coronary syndrome is reflux, GERD, because people know what heartburn is. They've had heartburn before, and so the closest thing they can describe it to is heartburn. They can't say, well, this feels just like what I would experience if my LAD was occluded. Because right. they have no idea what that feels like.
Right.
So get us, you know, talk about some of those tools and tips. You mentioned mm-hmm. plus one, chest pain plus one. So what are some of those things that we need to consider in that balance? We're not going to catch every one of them. There is a fine balance between you know, catching as many as safely as possible, doing the most good for the most number of people, because there is risk associated with contrasted studies. We do know over time, especially in younger folks, the increased risk of cancer development. So there isn't, it's not like either of these choices is zero risk. There is risk associated with it, as well as the allocation and stewardship of the resources that we have, which apparently in this country we don't act like are limited by any stretch, but at some point we will.
Right. Yeah, and we should. We should definitely think that way. And obviously the way, when I gave my talk actually, I only had one slide on CTA. And my slide was just to show a picture of a CTA of a dissection. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of that talk that I gave is that, you know, you should be reaching conclusions about dissection without just ordering CTAs on people. And because the study I mentioned earlier, way at the beginning of the postmortem findings, clearly show that even though we're in a modern age now of CTA, that getting the CTAs hasn't changed really or improved our detection rate of dissection. So clearly what we need to improve on is not just the fact we got to order more CTAs and, you know, be suspicious of chest pain patients, is we got to be asking the right questions and doing the right exam. And so I guess the couple myths that we need to debunk is the whole, first is the hypertension. So patients that present to the ED with high blood pressure for dissection is only about 50% of patients. Mm-hmm. It's much less than we think it is. So if you have a patient with back pain, they have normal blood pressure, you can't just say, that's not a dissection. You know, that's not true. Only about 50% of patients will have elevated blood pressure in the ED. About 35% will have high blood pressure, and then 8% or so will have hypotension. And then be in shock, and those are different type of class of patients, right? The other thing is the exam findings. So at least in my place, there's this weird myth that has somehow infiltrated. You know how there's like each ED has its own weird little things about it. You know, like I worked at one ED one time that got glucoses on everybody, like everyone. Like ankle pain, you got a glucose, a finger stick. I guess it's like that one time in that one ED's history where someone didn't get a glucose stick and they had a hypoglycemic, you know, code or something. And then since then, everyone gets a glucose stick. It's befuddled me why that happens. But in my ED, particularly, there's this myth that everyone that has back pain should get blood pressures measured in both arms for a dissection check. And they mm-hmm. all, and the nurses, you know, were told at one time, and it's been passed down nurse to nurse to nurse and every doctor and resident, that, oh, if you have a difference in 20 millimeters mercury between your arms, that's a dissection risk. That's what we're taught in med school too, right? It turns out that that's complete wash. It's hogwash. And they found that they did a study years ago, and they found that the majority of the population, as you and I would suspect, have 50% actually of the patients in this one study had a greater than 20 millimeter mercury blood pressure difference, and they had nothing wrong with them. They're just like you and me. And so it's a complete silly myth. So I would stop doing that, first of all. Don't just measure blood pressures in the arm.
That's not going to be your rule out.
It's not going to be your rule out or rule in. It's just nothing. And so what actually, on the exam, the only two findings that are really concerning for dissection are pulse deficits and then neurologic deficits, focal neurologic deficits. Again, going back to that whole stroke presentation, These patients can come in with neurologic deficits and pulse deficits. You know, just taking that 5 seconds to check radio pulses or DP pulses is going to be a key to seeing, okay, well, hey, this pulse is absent in their left radial and they're complaining of chest pain. You should automatically be thinking about a dissection. And then we talked about the types of pain, right? Talked about sudden onset versus gradual. We talked about tearing or sharp pain versus pressure-like. And then where it radiates to, you know, is it migrating to the belly? Is it migrating to the back? And those are things that I think about and what you should be asking.
Well, and for everybody out there who's wondering, there's a good Southeastism, the hogwash.
Yeah.
Came from the 1500s, 15th century.
Yeah.
And it has to do with just what you think it was, is everything that's kind of left over that's the swill for the pig.
Yeah. Thanks for defining that.
Yeah. And, you know, I like, you know, sitting here is two guys who did residencies in our programs in the Southeast. You know, there's those communication styles and those words that, you know, if you're far enough west or northeast, you know, what in the world is hogwash about?
Yeah.
So you've got your pulse deficits and your neurologic deficits, which are going to be those go-to things. And you actually hit on something I think maybe I'm just the only one that feels this thing, that where we're trying to keyhole so many of our patients into STEMI, sepsis, stroke, mm-hmm. whatever it may be,
yeah.
that we run that risk of a significant anchoring bias. You know, you run back there and you're working up one singular diagnosis, and the whole idea of successful diagnosis is a broad differential, being able to take in the whole picture when people come in versus, you know, laser focusing on one certain thing. So, and that may be, you know, what you talked about. I agree, every department has that weird thing that they do. Ours is an EKG on anything that gets within 100 yards. You know, our ankle pains get, they're like, why are we getting an ankle pain?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, well, it's connected to the abdomen, which is connected to the chest. And we can do that whole song thing again. But the bigger challenge is, you know, with the physicians that are that way.
Yes.
Once had one patient that had this, so every single one of my
yes.
workups is going to, in fact, I remember one of my last cases as a resident, the attending that was with me, he only came in with ankle pain. And it was a decent mechanism. I don't know if it was a fall MVC or something, but he had ankle pain. But everything else checked out. Everything else completely negative. My plan initially was to just do an ankle x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, the ankle, well, it is broken. Is that a distracting injury? Yeah, it could be. I guess it could be distracting.
I see where this is going.
And then all of a sudden, like, okay, then we better get a C-spine. Okay, well maybe need to. Well, what if something's in their chest and abdomen? And next thing you know, we've got a pan scan on somebody who comes in for isolated ankle injury. And that's kind of sometimes why I'm happy that a lot of traumas, not significant traumas, go to community hospitals, because you don't anchor on this whole how can we talk ourselves into a pan scan.
Yes.
And so this guy with ankle pain ends up with everything, head, spine, chest, abdomen, pelvis, because then, of course, you get into the argument that you don't want to, if we only want to have to send them over there once, what if we find something? We don't want to have to send them over twice or three times. And so mm-hmm. then you end up with a pan scan, $15,000 or plus worth of imaging for somebody who ends up with a distal fibula fracture, which is what it ended up being. But, you know, that the whole idea of with these types of things, with these more high-risk, lower-frequency diagnoses, the potential of anchoring into something that we're trying to do for some sort of metric, and which is impressive that you were able, once you got a stroke, of saying, wait a second, let's just scan all the way through, because even though we're into this pathway, I think that we need to broaden it out because this doesn't make sense as a stroke.
Right.
So, you know, talking about that thought of keeping this in the differential, but not, you know, one, not anchoring into something that is more likely, but also at the same time not shelving something when this is the case and may have the clues and subtleties that you need to pick up.
You know, I completely agree. And obviously when we talk about this isn't, we're not saying that you need to do order CTAs now in your STEMIs, and quite the opposite. It's when you're handed those EKGs from triage and you say, this patient has a STEMI. It's not activate the cath lab, it's let me go see the patient, and let me go talk to them, let me go see what's going on. A STEMI patient, normally 90-something percent of the time, should be awake, alert, talking to you that they're having a STEMI. It's very rare they have altered sensorium. So if they are coming in and saying, yeah, my back's killing me, and they have a STEMI, mm-hmm. you need to actually be concerned about dissection. About 5% of dissections have STEMIs associated with them because of coronary ischemia from the dissection. 20% of dissections have troponin elevations. So, you know, going back in the room and saying, this is an NSTEM, I'm going to give them heparin, is probably not the right move, probably actually the opposite of the right move. And same thing with a stroke. And I know we're hammering stroke, but it's just, there is such a high correlation with neurologic deficits and syncope and altered sensorium that are associated with dissections, that it's important to think when you have a stroke patient, is it really a stroke? You know, you're going to go see the code stroke, call a neurology team if you're blessed to have neurology at your institution or some type of telestroke or whatever, and then that's it. You know, or am I going to go in the room and actually do a physical exam? I'm actually going to like ask a few questions like, okay, well, actually, what happened an hour ago? You know, is it the, oh yeah, I had right facial tingling and left arm numbness, or is it actually, no, I had actually like a few hours ago, I had chest pain, you know, and now I started feeling this weird way, my head hurts too, and that. And that's all implying that this is something more than just a stroke, right? So those are the aspects that are really important. There was one study they did several years ago, in the 2010s, I think, and it was this prospective study that was measuring how physicians ask questions about dissection. And there are three questions they found that were really predictive of priming a physician to think about a dissection. Mm-hmm. And the three questions were things we've mentioned already. The onset of pain, was it sudden or gradual? The quality of the pain, was it sharp or tearing? Tearing being obviously a higher likely ratio, but sharp is still really good. And then the third question was, where does it radiate to? And obviously the way we ask these questions is important, because you and I both know, especially with working with residents and students, that when you go in a room and you prime a patient, you say, does it radiate to your back? Almost everyone's going to say, oh, yeah, sometimes, you know, I guess. Or is it sharp, tearing, or pressure? Like, or you ask them, like, is the pain sharp? They're, you know, again, they're going to say, like, oh, yeah, I think it is. And you go back in the room 5 minutes later and say, well, is it pressure-like? And they're like, oh, yeah, I guess it is, too. So, I'm obviously, it's not the patient's fault. They're just they're being primed, right? You're going in the room and you're telling them, like, I'm asking you something. What do you think?
You're leading the witness.
Yeah, exactly. And you're leading the witness on. And so instead of asking those open-ended questions, like, hey, if you had to tell me where the pain's moving, if it's in your chest, where do you feel it moving anywhere else? You know, asking questions in layman's terms and not leading them on is really important. If they say, without any prompting, yeah, it's going straight to my back, that's concerning. You know, it's definitely out of the patient without you priming them. Same with the sudden onset of pain, like, hey, what were you doing when the pain started? Not, did it start suddenly, you know, because everyone's going to say yes to that. You say, what were you doing when the pain started? They say, like, oh, well, you know, I don't know, a few days ago. That sounds like gradual, or they don't really know. Versus, oh, yeah, I was cooking dinner. I remember I walked over the dishwasher or the sink, and this happened. Like, it immediately hit me. That's concerning for sudden onset pain. Regardless, if you ask those three questions and you get positive answers for them, they found that study that physicians suspected a dissection in more than 90% of patients, and that correlated well to diagnosing a dissection mm-hmm. later. Versus if physicians ask one or two of those quality questions or historical questions, they only suspected dissection about 40%. They had a higher miss rate. So what we ask is really important. How we ask it is really important.
Absolutely. And keeping that in that differential, getting some of those key questions. With this, it seems to be one of the most stable diagnoses with regard to management. I mean, it's not one that's significantly evolved. And of course, our gold standard is not as much the aortogram like it was 20 years ago, but you know, looking at the CTAs and those types of evaluation tools, has there been any significant change, evolution in management? It seems more of the diagnostics have changed, but not as much the management.
Correct. Yeah, the management's pretty much still the same. And my talk was focused on, obviously, how to not miss a dissection. I didn't want to. It would be a disservice to try to squeeze in 30 minutes everything into like critical care management, because that's a whole separate mm-hmm. interesting conversation. But you're exactly right. The two most important fundamental pillars of management in ED, besides calling a vascular surgeon, is going to be blood pressure management as quickly as possible and pain management. They discovered that the pain fiber of response, sympathomimetic pain response, is obviously a deadly positive feedback loop. The more sympathomimetic catecholamine release you have, the higher afterload you have. And it's all about reducing the afterload, as you know. Reducing that blood pressure as fast as possible. I tell my residents and students all the time that, you know, we talk about hypertensive emergency, and there's this whole debate about the reality and the validity of hypertensive urgency and what conditions you want to lower the blood pressure fast or slow. That's debated, but there is no debate among any physician in vascular surgery or critical care that if you have an aortic dissection, that is the one diagnosis where you want to drop that blood pressure from wherever it is to 100 or low as possible as fast as possible. Systolic, of course. So you want to give them rapid-acting IV agents, you know, labetalol as you're waiting for Esmolol, but Esmolol preferably is your number one agent. adding on a calcium channel blocker like nicardipine or clovidipine as a backup if your esmolol isn't cutting it, but you want to be as aggressive as possible. And unfortunately, you'll be working in environments where you may be working with certain people that may not feel comfortable dropping that as fast as possible because they've learned at one time, like, oh, we don't want to cause any harm. Well, the harm is going to be the dissection. So you want to drop this as fast as possible. It's been directly correlated. The term is called, it's a special pathology term, it's called intrinsic lumen collapse, which is fancy doctor word for the higher the blood pressure is, the more the aorta is going to unzip and break open. And it's directly correlated. The higher the pressure, the more that the blood will be shot into that tear in the defect in the wall. And so lowering the blood pressure as rapidly as possible is still absolutely the cornerstone management. You want to be very aggressive.
All right, talking here with Dr. Briggs, give us link information on not only the board bombs, but how folks can get in touch with you if they have any questions, want to pepper you with some dissection talk.
I would love to. Thanks for having me on. It's been great. Good seeing you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So where can folks get your podcast and what's a good contact for
Absolutely.
You?
So my Twitter, you can send me direct messages on Twitter, but it's Blake Briggs, MD. Or I guess the at symbol before that, right?
Oh,
so at Blake Briggs, MD on Twitter. And then, of course, if you go to Board Bombs, emboardbombs.com, there's a contact page, easy to follow. You can see any email. You can send us a general question. You can also sign up on that website for, you get email updates. We also, Ryan, since last year, it was in its infancy, but now it's prime time. We have a new premium podcast content on our website now. We offer, we're pioneering the new trademark term drip learning instead of bolus learning.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are doing is we have a separate special podcast that we host on a private RSS feed that you can just go to our website and download, sign up. It's all in one click, and it downloads directly to your podcast player. But what we do is 2 to 4 minute board prep podcast. And so, yes, we have a general board prep podcast we have right now, but we have these, we call it the Rapid Fire EM Board Bombs podcast, Rapid Bombs. And what we do is just 4 minute episodes of, we give you a multiple choice question like you would encounter on the board exam, and we just go through it, like talking about the answer choices, talking about the answer. And then we do something called coaching where we tell you, this is how they would typically ask this question on the boards. Like for dissection, for example, like what are they going to want to know, what agents you want to use, and how fast you want to drop the blood pressure, that sort of thing. And what's your target? And so we've been doing that for over a year now. We have over hundreds of subscribers now. And we're really excited to keep that going. So encourage anyone to check it out and let us know if you're interested in trialing it out. So
absolutely. And this podcast, I've never been a one that's edged away from supporting other great content out there. Of course, at the end of this podcast, if you wait long enough, you're going to hear the tagline from Ken Millman. He put together the front line versus the sidelines. But, you know, making sure that there's great information, great education, because I feel like the more care, the better care we can provide is by having the most and best information and, of course, information tailored into the way you like to learn. So I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Good seeing you again.
Good
here down
again
in Destin. You know, we've been sitting here out here in a hallway, sitting in these comfy chairs with our, flip-flops on. You're dressed nicer than I am.
Yeah.
I'm here, shorts and flip-flops, because today's golf day in the afternoon, so sorry about that. But appreciate, good seeing you again, and look forward to it, and thanks a lot.
Absolutely, thank you.
As for me, you can contact me, rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, or at EverydayMed on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASEP Frontline.